Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Which one is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's
world service.
That's, yeah, they have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you want?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to need it.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down Swampfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
Everyone talks about Mondays in Ireland. Everything is a slog on a Monday. Ah, Mondays. Fucking hell. Those were the words of Damien Duff last week about attitudes in the League of Ireland towards Monday Night Football. But he could just as easily have been talking about how a lot of people in society feel about this particular day. Thankfully, it's a bank holiday today, so hopefully a lot of you are getting a break from the usual grind and are enjoying this episode of the Second Captain's Football Pod in as relaxed a frame of mind as possible. Hey, Ken.
Oh, and how are you?
Shamrock Rovers have had they've had very few problems playing football on any night of the week. In recent years, they already had their...
Apart from Thursday night.
Thursday nights, yeah. I suppose Europe has been a bit more of a... Forget Thursdays. Most other nights of the week, certainly domestically, they already had their third league title in a row wrapped up before beating second place Derry City in Tala last night. On an emotional evening, Stephen Bradley has spoken before about his son Josh, who has leukemia. Josh was the star of the show yesterday, front and centre, lifting the trophy. Bradley said afterwards, it was a special night, three in a row, with everything that's gone on personally. I spoke to the players and asked them, could they give us this night for Josh? There have been some difficult nights, so could they give us this one, something that he has been looking forward to and takes his mind off the treatment? So some nice stuff there. We're going to chat to the 42.ie's David Snaid about Rovers' hat-trick of titles on the show today. Tomorrow, for World Service members only, we look ahead to Ireland against South Africa in the rugby. We'll have Champions League coverage throughout the week and loads more for only a fiver a month plus VAT on secondcaptains.com. Now, Ken, please report on some sport.
Well, Anne, it's obviously a lot of people, I think, have already commented on the fact that it's been a very disappointing day for Brazil's footballers.
Did they lose a match? Was there a friendly international I didn't know about?
Some of them lost matches, Anne. Some of them won matches. But for most of them, they were looking at the election results, for the overnight election results for Brazil with some despondency as their boy, Jair Bolsonaro, became the first Brazilian president to not win re-election when he was standing for it, losing the runoff to Lula. So a shattering blow. A shattering blow to many of these football players who I suppose they can maybe go out to Qatar and bring back one more for the Gipper.
Tim Vickery really was scratching around trying to find footballers who weren't supporting Bolsonaro, or who were going the other way, I should say, in the election. It was, you know, relatives of Socrates and this sort of stuff, but largely the ones who were front and center, the ones who were speaking in any way on either side of the current batch, most of them seem to be Bolsonaro heads.
Yeah, I mean, there's always the fact that maybe you're less willing to state your support for the opposition candidate while Bolsonaro is still in power, and maybe now you're going to, oh, well, I was with Lula all along. You know, you're going to see a bit of that coming out. I mean, I guess when you look at the map, the electoral map, I mean, you can see that the Bolsonaro support is concentrated in the south of the country Which is where the biggest cities are as well. I mean, Sao Paulo and Rio and south of there, but also a huge chunk in the Amazon, which is, I guess, more lightly populated, but like so pro Bolsonaro. This is the, you got to remember that's the people in the Amazon who are voting, not all the other species. So they are.
Sorry, I should laugh. This being one of the more important things going on in the world now.
Yeah, trees don't vote, Owen. No, but the people who live in the Amazon would like to see less of them. As far as they're concerned, they've got more trees than you can shake a stick at. And it's high time we cut down some of these trees.
Literally can't see the wood from the trees at the moment, these voters.
Yeah, whereas the rest of the Lula support is more in the northern half of the country and around the northeast. So you could, I suppose, look at where the players came from and make crude assumptions about them based on that. But, you know, let's not do that. It's actually a pointless exercise. But that was obviously a big thing that was happening. What else is happening? It was quite an interesting weekend of football, actually. We'll start at the very top, Owen. Arsenal Football Club, who were up against the team Nottingham Forest, high on their victory last week against Liverpool, and just absolutely wiped the floor with them. I would say the key is to score a relatively early goal, as Arsenal did with Martinelli, but they actually had some sort of nervous spells after that, particularly when Saka. You know, Saka got injured and had to go off, and that's obviously a concern, although Arteta says he thinks he's going to be okay for the World Cup. But it was in the second half then that they just crushed them, you know. Reece Nelson, obviously Thomas Partey scoring his goal. He's very good at that shot, that particular shot. Just sort of almost side-footing the ball into the top corner from anywhere from 20 to 40 yards from goal. And a couple of assists for Gabriel Jesus, who hasn't scored now in 7 matches. But it's not about the goals. You know, it's about what he gives the team. So, it can't really be going any better for Arsenal.
No, the real deal.
I mean, you look at them now and you're like, well, these are, you know, who is better? Who's better in the Premier League at this moment in his position than Martin Odegaard? Kevin De Bruyne, maybe? You know, who is better?
Erling Haaland.
Well, Odegaard isn't a striker, you know. I mean,
Haaland. Oh, sorry. I thought you meant in his position, as in, yeah. Well, sorry. Who plays better in the position they play in? Which would just be another way of saying who's the best player.
Haaland, I think most people would probably agree. Haaland is a forward.
Yeah.
But, you know, Martinelli, like, who has been better than Martinelli as a wide forward in the league? I can't think of anyone who's been on that level. You know, then you look at like Xhaka. I mean, Xhaka has been having an absolutely outstanding season, which I certainly can't claim any credit for having seen that one coming. You know, because ever since Xhaka has been at Arsenal, I've always thought, no, this guy just isn't really, he's not at the level.
Well, I mean, a lot of Arsenal fans thought the same.
Yeah. But maybe, you know, given time, he's certainly exceeded the expectations, the modest expectations I put on him. Saliba obviously is doing brilliantly. You know, I don't see players at Man City, defenders at Man City who have been better than him. You know, Ben White's having a great season. You know, so many players are playing so well. The first half of this season is almost perfect. I mean, they're close to signing off on a virtually perfect first half of the season. And then obviously the big question is going to be whether they're going to be able to resume in the same sort of rhythm that they have established and which has been so effective after the World Cup, and obviously the pressure of, well, we actually are going for this against Man City now, you know, as opposed to we're just doing our thing, you know, we're just trying to focus on the next game and win our games. You know, the pressure of actually competing directly with City is going to bring a new psychological element. But, you know, at the moment, it's looking really, really positive. And you can't really do much better than 5-0. Obviously, Man United playing then yesterday as well and getting another win. Rashford with his 100th goal. And that
De Gea doing his thing.
Well, De Gea, you know, I mean, United definitely will have felt pretty pleased to have won this game at the end, because some of the saves De Gea made in the last 15 minutes were sensational. I mean, the one from the header, I can't remember I can't remember which West Ham player actually had the header. It was going right in the corner.
Yeah.
you know, there was a shot by Declan Rice where he maybe needed to take a leaf out of Partey's book and just have that one either slightly higher or slightly more in the corner, because when you're shooting from that far out, you are giving De Gea, even though he struck the ball really well, you're giving De Gea enough. It's a little bit telegraphed. He can read what you're going to do, and he read it very well, but it was ultimately a comfortable save. The one where he dived to his right to put a header around the post was a phenomenal save. Mm-hmm. And it's funny the way that he does this. Like, he goes through these kind of unbeatable quarter hours. Now, more so than any goalkeeper I can remember. Just that sort of, like, I'm just going to save whatever's coming at me. And you saw his celebrations at the end. I mean, obviously, because it was a big one for the team, but it's also kind of a big one for him because his contract is being discussed at the moment. Or Ten Hag says, we're going to think about what we're going to do with his contract over the World Cup, through the World Cup. So what are we going to do? What are we going to do about this? Because De Gea is obviously one of the best paid players in the world. And the question is whether he still deserves to be at a team like Man United, who whatever this sort of transitional phase that they're going through at the moment is under Erik ten Hag going to be a possession team that where the goalkeeper is expected to be, you know, a footballer. And that's the big question with De Gea. I mean, I've kind of said already that I think he's not the right goalkeeper if that's what you're trying to do. But obviously, he has got some outstanding attributes, which he showed yesterday. So it's a dilemma. I think it might be best for them to, rather than sign De Gea, I mean, they still have another option, I think, an option for an extra year in his current deal. But, you know, there's a reason why De Gea is probably not going to be going to the World Cup with Spain. Partly it has to do with just some bad games that he's had for Spain. Sometimes a goalkeeper can play a couple of bad games for the national team and everyone decides, oh, this guy's soft. You know, especially if, like, you play in a different country and, you know, how many people are going to be watching his unbeatable quarter hour against West Ham in Spain. But mainly it has to do with them thinking that he can't play football. You know,
does in the way that necessarily, though? I know we say Ten Hag needs to be able to have a goalkeeper who can do that, but Ten Hag has already shown himself to be willing to compromise, at least in the short term, on principles.
This isn't a short-term decision, though.
I know, but who knows? Maybe his eyes are open to a new way of doing things.
That could be. Well, if so, maybe. You know, everybody would like a goalkeeper that just sort of stops everything, which De Gea on his good days can be. I mean, he has a record for saves in a game. Didn't he do that against the Arsenal in that crazy game where Man United won 3-1 at the Emirates, despite being absolutely hammered? He does have that. Like, you know, it is exceptional, but it's a kind of a balance. And I think for, you know, in terms of the overall balance, he is the wrong goalkeeper for them, for a Ten Hag team. But we'll wait and see. They're not deciding anything until after the World Cup. So what else is going on? Newcastle, of course, are rolling towards the top four. Maybe they really are going to go for it this season, which I didn't think they'd done enough to achieve. But obviously certain things Chelsea have been a little bit shaky. Obviously Liverpool, who we'll get to, have totally collapsed. And it's opening up a little bit for them. You know, obviously 4-0, Villa had that great win. Aaron Danks, though, didn't go quite so well this time out. Reverse.
Oh, poor old Aaron Danks. He gets his amazing moment through his win, 3-0. If he could have walked away then, if Unai Emery's work permit, if all that paper could have been done just a little bit faster, Emery's in the dugout at the weekend and Danks sails off. Instead, he has to watch a 4-0 win and be the manager during a concussion controversy.
Well, I mean, come on. That was crazy, though. That was insane that they let him go back on there. You know, like, what, like, how is that still happening?
With the usual provisos that you know, they would have gone through the protocols, and that's what
I know. But it does make you look a bit foolish when your goalkeeper like rolls over on his back and looks like he's about to puke like a few minutes after you've sent him back on. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, yeah, sorry, I know I'm not privy to exactly what passed between Martinez and the doctors. It's just that what I see from looking on, it tells a certain story. You know, the story is there. We can all see what happened.
If in doubt, sit it out thing, which is what the FA say, you know, that's supposed to govern all protocols, whatever about all the ins and outs of the specific things that are supposed to happen. There's also a doctor, by the way, in the tunnel who's looking at the footage as well. So that should alleviate a bit of the pressure on the medics who are on the pitch. Between all of them, you would think in a situation like that that there did seem to be some doubt. Certainly that's the way it appeared looking on TV, and that maybe Martinez should sit it out, but it didn't happen that way. It also raised the temporary sub thing isn't actually a perfect solution in rugby or other sports, but it's better. At least it gives a certain amount of time and gets the doctors away from the pitch and allows them to do their thing and wherever else in the stadium. So, you know, whether even it could be a little bit of a call to action to get that one through, because they do have the permanent sub thing, which you don't actually lose a substitute. No. You know, you can make that sub and you're not being punished, except that you're losing your first choice goalkeeper.
Yeah.
So, but still in a situation like that, it wasn't enough for them to pull him out. So it's pretty worrying, to be fair.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was a really solid knee to the head that he took from Tyrone Mings. So, you know, not great. I mean, as for Newcastle, really remarkable. You know, it's like as though someone made a wish on a monkey's paw for Keegan's Newcastle to return. And now this is what we've got.
Keegan's Newcastle conceded a lot more goals again.
Yeah. Well,
this is Keegan's Newcastle with a solid defence.
This is a new mean Keegan's Newcastle, rapping at the door of the top four. And, you know, and I'm sure people, Newcastle fans indeed, have pointed out that the best players, when you look at them, who are the outstanding players? I mean, you're talking about Almiron, of course, who's done this ability swap with Son this season. He's just basically, they've each turned into the other for somehow, and Almiron is just banging them in. Callum Wilson. These are all Mike Ashley era purchases, you know? Mm-hmm. Which raises the question, maybe Eddie Howe, who's done such a magnificent job, could be doing all this without Saudi Arabia's massive investment. Just with sheer coaching ability, you know, no dickheads policy, human qualities, organization, you know, all that stuff. Maybe he could just be doing that and we could be seeing this from Newcastle without also being one of the biggest spending clubs in the world thanks to Saudi Arabia's public investment fund. Oh, what a story that would be, eh? But I guess we'll never know. Because I guess it is sort of inseparable.
Eddie Howe is doing a really good job, though. You have to say, from where he took the club to how took over the club to how quickly they've gotten up into the Champions League spots, albeit with the money at his disposal. Nobody thought this was going to happen so quickly. For example, we've got an email in here from, we do get these, Ken, from Newcastle fans, Cormac Kennedy, who says, Ken's refusal to even remotely acknowledge that Eddie Howe is doing a very good job is triggering. I'm aware that part of the reason for this is my own internal conflict between loving watching this team and the moral concerns that I have. However, I don't see how it can be ignored how much improved Newcastle are in such a short period of time. The transformation of Joe Linton from comical £35 million striker to possibly the best midfield destroyer in the league is jarring to witness. Fabian Schär was being forced out of the club on a free transfer until Howe came in, and now he's performing at a Champions League level. Sean Longstaff is no longer a Championship level player. And what do I even need to say about Miguel Almiron at this point? The fact is that every single player that was at the club prior to Howe's arrival that's still there has been improved by him. Combine that with the drastic change in style of play in under a year to go from the team with the deepest defence in the league and lowest turnovers per 90 minutes to a team playing much higher up the pitch and turning the ball over more than anyone else in the league, and so on. Anyhow, doing a great job, Ken.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously they have improved a lot. But again, I think that the sort of infusion of an enormous amount of money and quality players, particularly like Bruno Guimarães, is a big part of that story.
Should have them, all of that, I think, should have them in the top 10 this season, which is where I saw Newcastle going. You know, they could have top 10, maybe
Top ten is not very ambitious. I mean, top
maybe have a go at the top six.
I would have said was a.
I didn't see Joe Linton being the midfield linchpin of a team going for the Champions League, and I think some of that is. I don't know, it is obviously, I think maybe it's hard in your head to separate, impossible in your head maybe to separate.
It's just a shame.
His coaching up those players that were already there from the circumstances of the ownership and so on.
It is a shame.
On a purity, if you can talk about it in a purity football sense, he is doing a very good job.
He's doing okay. You know, he's won 6 out of 13 matches after being one of the top spending clubs in the world. So, you know, like, let's keep our hair on, you know, in terms of handing out the Manager of the Year awards just yet. But I do feel as though, it's sad, isn't it, that all the credit's going to go to Saudi Arabia in the end. But I suppose that's the way it goes when you are Saudi Arabia's club. Of course, they're not the only team that spent plenty of money. Obviously, Chelsea did that and had a total disaster at Brighton. The first defeat for Graham Potter there, 1-0 down after 5 minutes. And that was actually a relief because Brighton had already nearly scored twice by the time they went 1-0 up. Ended up losing 4-1. The nodal thing about the game really was the way that Graham Potter's relationship with the Brighton fans is so bad.
What is the story with that? He's getting booed and everything. I suppose it happens.
Just this sort of peevish Graham Potter afterwards going, you know, I did a good job here, as you could see today from their team. You know, I left them in a pretty good place. Things obviously in a valley and a few things. I look a bit of a fool, he said. I mean, he's playing Sterling at wing back, and obviously that didn't work out so well. A bit of a mess really from Chelsea. Man City playing without Erling Haaland looked like they were. We do miss the big man. Alvarez, who had come in, didn't really have much impact in the game. I mean, it obviously needs a bit of adjustment. It was luckily their super scorer, Kevin De Bruyne, who won the game with a free kick. And I don't know if Diego Torres was watching the last minute, Owen, but Kevin De Bruyne burst from one end of the pitch to the other before playing in Gundogan for what should have been a tap-in and ended up not being a goal. It would have been a tap-in for some other Man City players who weren't involved in the game, but that's not everybody can do that. That was obviously an important win just to keep the pressure on Arsenal. So the other big game was obviously the one at Anfield on Saturday night.
Oh, Jesse Marsh. I love watching Jesse Marsh.
Do you?
Oh, he's. Did you see the celebration when the winning goal goes in?
Was it an air guitar?
I don't think it's air guitar. It's this is a very hard thing to do on, in audio.
Everyone has seen it.
It's the shaking of each of the hands. You know, the kind of. I'm doing it here, Ken. I'm doing it for people, and they can't see it. So I'm sort of shaking my right hand, my left hand, in a sort of, just shake, just move your body whatever way feels natural. But then at the end, what you got to do is you got to do a big fist up in the air. That's the kind of, clenched, teeth clenched, jaw clenched, everything clenched.
Well, it was a huge moment because, I mean, I don't know if the goal, the winning goal by Somerville saved his job, but I think the results. You know, I mean, a 1-1 draw at Anfield would have been regarded, I think, by Leeds as a pretty good result. By Jurgen Klopp as a good result, as he said after the game. But to win at Anfield is huge. And, okay, it doesn't necessarily mean anything. We saw what happened to Nottingham Forest in their next game after beating Liverpool. And as Marsh said, you know, we have to use this to launch ourselves. But, you know, I think he was going to get sacked after the game if they lost. And now he's not going to get sacked at least until they lose the next game. So, you know,
a win at Anfield has to buy you two games, surely.
You think so, right? It puts him back in the game because he was on the way out, right? I'm pretty sure that Jesse Marsh was on the way out at Leeds. Win that game suddenly and it changes things.
Why do you seem so certain that he was on his way out?
That was the talk out of the game. This is it. It's right. Lose this and they're gonna.
The way he was talking, I felt even after last game was, you know, when Jesse Marsh can talk, you know, he's articulate. He can talk a good game, but even he was struggling. How can you just keep talking when your team just can't buy a win? You know,
yeah.
And I just sort of felt like he looked quite defeated and deflated by his standards, but he got his mojo back.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Trent Alexander-Arnold doing an interview after the game. It's just something funny about the way he talks here. Clearly, as a team, something is not going right. It's not going as well as we want it to go. That's something for everyone to think about, for everyone to address and make sure we put it right, especially next week against Spurs, top four rivals. We kind of need to go there and get some points if we've got any chance of reaching our aims and aspirations for the season. Indeed, Trent.
just the rally cry.
Comical understatement of this little speech. I thought this was a really worrying game for Liverpool. Because unlike the Nottingham Forest game, the Nottingham Forest game was a game I've seen them lose before, which was a sort of... Forest are defending with a lot of bodies. You know, it's difficult to get through them. They're having a couple of chances on the counter-attack. You know, but the main problem is, they had 75% possession or something like that. The main problem is an inability to translate, you know, domination of the ball and territory into clear-cut chances and goals, you know, and if you didn't, and then you lose the game. This Leeds game was totally different. This game was an end-to-end broken game. You know, Ten Hag described the United West Ham game as like a tennis match, you know, because I'm sort of looking from one end to the other really quick. It was one of those types of games. Frequent turnovers, you know, the defense is caught out of position, loads of space. This is exactly the sort of game Liverpool are supposed to revel in. This is the kind of game that they've been throughout, you know, most of Jurgen Klopp's time set up to win, and they didn't. You know, it's not like that Forest game where it's like, oh, where's the chance going to come from? You're passing it around, can't find a gap. You know, it's not quite happening. This was like this chance after there are plenty of chances. Well, they didn't actually create that many chances, but they had space. They had opportunities over and over and over again, and they couldn't do it. I mean, Darwin Nunez obviously had chances to win the game. You know, players miss chances. Like, did you see Kylian Mbappe's miss from Neymar's assist of the century over the weekend?
No.
Neymar pulled out a dribble past several players, which culminated in a spinning, like a roulette back heel through ball into the pass of Mbappe, who's in on the left side of the penalty area in his classic goal scoring position, and all he needs to do is like sweep it into the corner, as you've seen him do 100 times, and he kicks it straight at the goalkeeper. And it's actually unbelievable that he would miss that after the setup. It was astonishing. But you know, this happens even to the best players, of which Kylian Mbappe is probably currently the best. However, Darwin Nunez is no Kylian Mbappe, right, who is an all-round exceptional player who does every aspect of the game really well. A player like Nunez, who doesn't get involved constructively in the build-up and frequently is giving the ball away, he has to score. Right, he has to score the chances, because otherwise, what's he giving the team? You know, and there was two great chances, one in the first half where the obvious thing was to kind of lob the goalkeeper, who was miles off his line, didn't do it because he wasn't confident enough to try it on his left foot. And then one in the second half, which was actually more like the miss Mbappe had, where he's played in by Salah. You know, it's a good goal scoring chance. You could go around the goalkeeper as well, but that would involve using your left foot. And he missed both of them. And okay, that's disappointing, because you know you've missed the chances you've created, and now you're going to concede one as well. I mean, compared Nunez, for instance, to I know we were talking about his actually decent goals record. But, you know, to compare to Gabriel Jesus and what he's doing at Arsenal, and all he's giving them, even though he hasn't scored for 7 matches or whatever, he's still helping other players to score. And that's what Nunez doesn't really... I don't really see Nunez doing that, which is why his misses are significant when they happen, because, you know, that's what you're in the team to do. So this obviously now is a major problem for Liverpool. You know,
I thought defensively I'd be as worried as well.
I mean the defense, you know, it was Van Dijk's first defeat at Anfield or whatever in the league, and you know, and you see kind of how, I mean, Gomez of course made a mistake, but Alisson slipped at the same time. Van Dijk wasn't watching, because he kind of assumed that the ball was just going to go to Van Dijk, and that's where Leeds' first goal came from. Then the one Klopp was really angry about was the second goal, where they had loads of players around the ball, nobody able to challenge. But what's happened is I've seen a few kind of pieces or quite a lot of commentary about, like, this is, you know, once again, it's the 7-year itch, right? And it's the comparison of, well, Klopp's Dortmund ran out of steam after 7 years, and now the same thing is happening again. And I think this is one of those situations where, because something a bit like this happened before, people kind of act as though it's the same thing happening again. You know, one of the frequently told stories about Klopp's time at Liverpool is how, I think it was Ian Graham, their director of research, went to Klopp at some point and said, oh, you know, sort of showed him, talked to him about his last season at Dortmund and was saying, oh, you know, you were really unlucky in this game, really unlucky in that game. And Klopp was like, oh my God, you watched these games? And he's like, no, I didn't watch them, but I've been looking at the stats. And I know that was kind of a weird, what happened to Dortmund was weird. It was just one of those weird runs of losing, yeah, and so on and so forth. I mean, and so there's that, you know, I don't think you can say that about what Liverpool have been doing. You know, if you look at their games, that game last against Leeds was an even game. You know, the XG was more or less even. They lost the XG against Forest. They lost that game. They lost the XG against West Ham, a game which they won. They lost it comprehensively against Arsenal. Obviously, they lost the game by a narrower margin than that. You know, they had the draw against Brighton again. It was a very even game. The draw against Fulham. It's not like they've been hammering teams and getting unlucky results. It's been bad performances, even matches or matches where they've had the worst of it and results to match. But I feel like the main problem that Dortmund had was a very obvious one. It was losing star players every season, you know, and they had this constant bleed of players, and the player that they lost going into his last season, the 7 year, when it all kicks in, was Lewandowski, you know, who's been the striker of the century in Germany, like the decisive player in the Bundesliga for almost his entire career in that league, right? So he went to the main rival team in a free transfer. It's impossible to conceive of a more crushing transfer than that. But, you know, Dortmund had already had Götze leaving, also to Munich, Kagawa to Man United, Perisic, Nuri Sahin before them. You know, this was season after season. That was the pattern. They would always lose top players. And, you know, and Hummels was to leave to Munich after this as well. You know, it didn't stop. Royce is the only one who's kind of stayed there the whole time. Royce, who himself was signed to replace one of the other departing players. So that hasn't been the situation at Liverpool. Like, they have lost players. For instance, they let Gini Wijnaldum go because they didn't want to pay him as much as PSG were paying him. Sadio Mane has joined Bayern, and that is a big superficial similarity, you know, to match the Lewandowski thing. Also a star player. But I still don't feel as though that's as significant an issue as if you look at the squad composition. This is the real difference. So Dortmund, when they had this terrible season, 2014-15, when the players were supposedly worn out from you know what Klopp had been putting them through, they had a very, very young squad. So you had only three players over the age of 30 in the squad. One of them was the goalkeeper, Weidenfeller. You know, and the other 30 plus guys, Sebastian Kehl was one. They're not playing every minute. If you look at the players who were actually mostly in the team, it's guys like Subotic, Mkhitaryan, Bender, Kagawa, Royce, Hummels, all 25 years old. Immobile, the striker they signed to replace Lewandowski, who failed, was 24. Gundogan was 23. Right, so these were the core players in the team, and they were all in their mid-20s, like at a really good age. You know, some of them were getting injured, some of them, you know, were seeing a lot of shots hit the post and this kind of thing, but it wasn't a sort of a fundamental, these guys are going to have to be replaced issue. I mean, it's like, it'd be great if we could hang on to these guys for a change. I mean, that was kind of that sort of a thing about that. Liverpool have 9 players who are aged over 30 in the squad. And 8 of them have been playing significant minutes. Adrian's the only exception. So 8 have played quite a lot of minutes, or appeared in a lot of games, or would be key players if they weren't injured. So like Joel Matip. So you're looking at Virgil van Dijk, Alisson, Salah, Thiago, Henderson, Milner, and Firmino. as well as Fabinho too is 29 and has, you know, seemed, looks older. He's an old 29 by the looks of it, right? And that's a lot of players in that bracket. If you look at that mid-20s category, who do you have there? Jota injured, Diaz injured, Tsimikas, who's kind of, you know, a reserve, and Trent Alexander-Arnold, Gomez, and Naby Keita, wherever he is. You know, Darwin is 23. He's obviously been in and out. And then a couple of sort of 19 or 20-year-olds, Carvalho and Elliot, who've played quite a lot. So it's that middle section of the squad that's become depopulated. And that, I think, that's really what's going on here. They can't handle the schedule anymore. So Leeds had a week to prepare for the game. Liverpool played in Amsterdam on Wednesday night and come back, and they just can't do what they used to do. And they can't.
It did strike me when you were talking earlier on about the end-to-end nature of the game and how much space there was, that's a great thing to have for a team. If you've got somebody like Brendan Aaronson in there for Leeds, busting a just absolutely amazing. I thought he was brilliant. I think he's a really good player. Just reading here, he ran 13.2 kilometres, which is more than anyone else in the Premier League over the weekend. Yeah. That's actually the kind of player Liverpool don't have anymore.
Yeah, and then, you know, now they actually want the game to be slower and more patient. You know, they've kind of lost that old strength they had, where if the game turned into a fast-running game, that they were going to come out on top of that. They can't do that anymore. And that's why I say that I think this is a worse situation than Dortmund had, because I don't really see, like with Dortmund, they turned it around in the second half of the season. You know, players came back from injury. You know, the ball started going in instead of hitting the post or whatever. Whereas in this situation, I mean, I'm sure they can play better. And obviously the players coming back from injury is also a factor, but it's hard to see how they can kind of become the team they used to be. I mean, if you compare it to their rivals, Arsenal only have Xhaka over the age of 30, who's a regular part of the team. At Man United, you've got Eriksen, Casemiro. They're both 30. Ronaldo and De Gea is obviously the goalkeeper. Ronaldo is in a slightly separate category, but they're the only sort of players in this category. At Tottenham, it's Perisic and Son. They've got a few players in their late 20s. You know, Matt Doherty. Hugo Lloris, obviously, again, the goalkeeper. City of Walker, Gundogan, Mahrez, and De Bruyne, who are over 30, who regularly play. Chelsea have seven. Kante, who's obviously been injured a lot, would be playing if he wasn't injured. Thiago Silva, Koulibaly, Mendy, Jorginho, Azpilicueta, and Aubameyang. So that's quite a few at Chelsea. They're not having a great season either. And Chelsea at least do have quite a few academy players too. You know what I mean? Whereas Liverpool's academy production hasn't been on that level. Hasn't been at Chelsea's. Chelsea have been populating teams. The Chelsea Academy players are everywhere. You know what I mean? So that hasn't really been performing for them either. And, you know, how are they going to turn this around? Like, there's pressure on them now to do something in January. But who are you going to get? Like, it seems as though the ability to get, you know, surprising good signings walked out the door with Michael Edwards as well. Arthur Melo was the solution that the sporting director came up with in summer. A complete disaster. You know, he's out basically for the way Klopp was talking, sounds like he might be out for the season, you know. So it's been great having him over as a sort of exchange student, but obviously he's been completely useless on the field. There's been this weird fixation on Jude Bellingham. I mean, it's not a weird fixation. The problem with it is, I think it's been a big mistake. They've kind of let it be known that, like, we're waiting for Bellingham. You know, they've done this before, like, say, for instance, remember
Van Dijk.
Exactly.
Yeah, that was a big one.
They didn't sign Van Dijk, and there was pressure to sign him. But the difference with Van Dijk is they were pretty confident. They were confident that Van Dijk is going to come, and maybe there's some basis for their confidence with Bellingham. But I think this is a bit different, because Bellingham is a huge star. Bellingham is going to be one of the biggest English players for the next 10 years, right? I mean, assuming he doesn't get injured. This is a player who everyone can see how brilliant this guy is, right? Their success, Liverpool's success, has come from signing players who weren't being chased by everyone else. Van Dijk and Alisson are the exceptions, but both are defensive players. And oftentimes, you know, Real Madrid are not going to, or not, like, say for instance, they tried to sign Tchouaméni from Monaco, and he chose to go to Real Madrid. Real Madrid are probably not going to compete with you to sign a £65 million goalkeeper. You know what I mean? They're like, well, he's a goalkeeper, you know, or a central defender. In the case of Bellingham, you know, I think Well, I think it would be a big relief to them if Bellingham ever ended up playing for them. But it just seems as though sort of declaring your intention miles out, we want to buy the most sought after player in England. Like, we're not actually going to sign him. We're just going to wait for that to happen down the line. You know, it's like, I don't think that's going to work. You know, I think they might have to come up with a couple of, and it looks as though, I mean, are they even in a position where they can afford to spend nearly all their money on Bellingham and then the rest of the team is already in place? No, not with that many players who are in that sort of position. So, that's what the point of this section was on. Yeah. This is not like Dortmund in 7 years ago. This is not some Klopp 7 year itch repeating pattern. This is different and worse.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Take your time there. Take your time.
Relax. Now. Oh, what a pass. What a reverse
Colin
pass.
Whelan.
Goal.
Whelan,
goal.
That's a goal for you, Didi.
Welcome to Evan Whelan. Welcome to Evan. Give him the ball on his feet. He will do the magic. Welcome to Evan.
Oh, he was amazing.
Welcome to Evan.
Whelan.
Fantastico. Welcome to Evan.
David Snaid was in Tala last night to be part of the... Well, part of the celebrations makes it sound as though you're a Shamrock Rovers supporter, David, which we know you're not, but emotional scenes nonetheless. It was a good night to be there, I'm sure.
Yeah, most definitely was not part of the celebrations, but was
you had your hoops. We know, David, you're a closet Shamrock Rovers fan.
Well, do you know what? I even went one step further with the kind of self-inflicted pain by deciding to do a kind of colour piece by talking to Rovers fans, which in fairness, probably not the best thing to want to do when they're going to be lifting a league title for 3 in a row, and then you're hearing someone talk about, oh, this is my 10th title, this is my 6th title, this is my 5th title. But now, like, it's, I know, when I think once you put your maybe on loyal, some kind of the loyalties you would have had growing up aside, and you obviously get cracking with the actual work of it, it was hard not to just take in the emotion of the occasion, to be honest. And then I'll be honest, obviously did have tears in my eyes when you see the young lad Josh Bradley go up and bring out the trophy with Ronan Finn and Roberto Lopez and Glenn Cronin, Stephen Bradley's assistant, bringing them down to the south stand, where obviously doing that kind of the wind up fist thing that Stephen Bradley has started doing this season. And I don't think anybody could not look at that and have a bit of a lump in their throat, to be honest.
Yeah, even the way Bradley talked about that afterwards, just saying that, look, he's you know, this gives Josh something else to think about for a few days. It was really nice.
Yeah, and he said that, you know, we saw that on TV and we kind of spoke to him afterwards as well. He said the same thing, and just even grabbing Roberto Lopez just before he went down the tunnel, before he had a big massive hug off Gavin Bazuna as well, who was waiting around for every single Rovers player. And he said the same. He just said, like, you feel as if football is a bit insignificant when, obviously, like, Josh is literally battling leukemia, and even when Rovers won the league, last week, and we spoke to Stephen Bradley. He was explaining how on the Friday before, when they beat Pats 4-1, he wasn't sure if he'd even be able to make it because he hadn't had a good day with his treatment. Kind of just puts it in perspective. But then again, Lopez made a point, goes, but if this is able to bring him a little bit of happiness and the family a little bit of happiness, well, then it is important. And I think something like that's to be remembered on a night like this, that football is important in many ways, you know, especially when, like, we was speaking to those people around, and I was joking about it at the start, but, like, literally, you're talking to generations of supporters and families, and I spoke to your man, one of the fellas off that Irish Gogglebox, who I didn't realise was a Rovers fan. And I just spotted him and got chatting to him, and he was even mentioning that even with his own family now, his own kids are beginning to go to matches, and it's brought his own family a bit closer together. You know, not just obviously, well, I'm guessing partly because they are having great success, and it's very enjoyable to go and watch Rovers play. Like, their attendance is, I think, on Friday nights have averaged, I think, around the 6,000 mark, which is phenomenal. And but just that, there was that sense, you know. And then even just speaking to a couple of older fans as well, and there's that bit of sadness too, because one of the, which I thought was very poignant line, he was explaining that, you know, like, you really enjoy these moments. This fella has been going to watch Rovers since the late 50s, early 60s, and he was talking about he's seen half of Rovers' league titles. And he was just saying, but on nights like this, he thinks of all the people who he used to go to matches with who've passed away and you would have shared moments with, and stuff like that just kind of reinforces what going to football is all about. It's obviously about trying to have, you want to see your team succeed, but it's also, as Brennan would say, about touching those close to you and having those embraces. And but that's what it is all about. It's about those bonds you make over decades, and that, those friendships and family, and just that family link, you know.
And do those Shamrock Rovers fans believe that this is the that they've never had it so good? This is the best it's ever been to be a Shamrock Rovers supporter?
Yeah, well, I think it's a mixture, because obviously there was that 4-in-a-row team of the 80s, so it was part of me thinking for just doing the piece on it today, was just like getting that sense of, well, you speak to some of the young kids, and obviously, like, let's be honest, they're loving it because they'll think the success isn't going to stop. And then you see, I thought it was a great moment where they were playing, I can't remember even that. I think it might have been Free From Desire. They were blaring it over the PA when the players were on the Lap of Honour. And this kind of middle-aged Rovers fan kind of came over to where the music was being played from, and was giving out, saying, it's too loud, we want to enjoy it, it's too loud. And then, like, everyone else around them was losing their minds, you know. But I just thought that was...
You know, it definitely was Freed From Desire. If it's a football match in 2022, it was almost certainly Freed From Desire.
Yeah. What's the song? I'm trying to think now, because I'm brilliant with music. Like, if you ask me, as you know, if you ask me any Neil Diamond song, I can name it right off the bat. But, like...
Well, you can sing it, well, let alone name it.
What's that song? You've got to pump it up. Oh, I can't remember. Anyway, so, yeah.
Pump up a jam.
I can't remember. I'm brilliant, man. I'm so bad with music, really. Yeah. I might shout down to my kid sister downstairs, like, if I say... She's like that. What's that Shazam app? She's like the human version of that, if you play, like, a couple of bars. But save me... But back to your question, like, you speak to some of the older, fans, they are making the point that obviously because of what the Rovers team did in the 80s, they have to go and match, to try and match that. But then there is that sense, you look what's happening in the club around Rovers, like, they're not going anywhere. Do you know what I mean? Like, obviously there could be that they might have to deal with maybe people coming for Stephen Bradley again, like, he could have went to Lincoln. They're beginning to, maybe you would think, have that plan in place for when he would eventually go. That would be the one thing at the moment that would derail the success. But, and you also look at the fact that the age profile of the team, there's definitely a case there where it does have to be freshened up in key areas, and they're going to be losing some key players like Andy Lyons, who, like, at 22, Neil Ferrugia, were 22, 23. Last night, Justin Ferrer's only 17. He's been linked with a move away. He's got a lot of talent. But then the age profile jumps up then to about 28, 29, and then it's into your 30s. There's not really a core of lads maybe in there other than, say, Jack Bourne, who's had his injury problems and didn't play, and Dan Cleary, who's come in, who would be around the 25, 26 mark. It's kind of, it jumps from being very young to maybe that other side of 30. Now, that's not writing off players, but that's just a natural thing you would look at in terms of having to freshen up and rebuild, and that's going to be the challenge now for Rovers, because you look at some other clubs that maybe had a bit of a demise, like Cork City with the financial side when they were challenging and win a league title, and they go down to the first division, and then Dundalk getting taken over by Peak Six, and then things just gone to absolute pot there, and then now they're rebuilding with their local owners again. You don't get that sense that there's going to be a major implosion with Rovers. It's just that boring old thing of making sure the football club and a team ticks over, and that's what the challenge will be to make sure that they can build on it.
How have they actually got to this position, Dave? I mean, you know, of total dominance, because it's not as though this is like just the way it's always been. I mean, they've three titles in the last three seasons, but it was like three in the previous 35 years nearly leading up to that. So, you know, what is it that they've done that no one else has been able to match?
Trust the process, Ken. It does seem if you go back a decade after Michael O'Neill left, and then they went through managers. They had Trevor Croy, they had Stephen Kenny, they had Pat Fennell, they had Brian Laws as a kind of caretaker. They were born and they obviously had qualified for the Europa League and had gone, and people were thinking then, right, this is Rovers going to dominate. But they kind of just fell into that trap of short-termism. Results weren't going well. Like, they got rid of Stephen Kenny 9 months into which a three-year contract, when he was trying to basically refresh that Michael O'Neill team. What we were talking about earlier, what Stephen Bradley has to do now with one of his own teams, and he got rid of him. And it was just a case of my looking at it from being an outsider and then obviously starting to cover them, it just looked as if they were beginning to panic. They were getting to a point where they were in a serious position of power after Michael O'Neill. They didn't know how to deal with it, and they just kind of panicked and burned through some cash and burned through managers and burned through players. And then in the summer of 2016, when that was kind of you have to look at it as the kind of turning point, because they get rid of Pat Fennell and then they bring in Stephen Bradley as their caretaker that summer just to get them through. I think his first game was a European game. I can't remember exactly who it was against. But even as a caretaker, he'd been around the club at that point. He'd obviously played for them, but he'd been working with, say, the youth system. Shane Robinson at that point was leading the youth system. And he's been obviously a former player as well, but he's been kind of running that youth system over the last number of years. And it's not all down to that. I know people talk about the youth system and stuff, but it has been Bradley driving what's happening in the first team. And you see that now with the age profile of the team. Like, they have that balance between realising that academy at the moment is very, very important, because obviously that's how Irish football is beginning to change with the underage leagues. Well, Stephen Bradley, once he took that permanent job as the manager, was working with the board, was working with obviously the people who are making the decisions, and was able to basically imprint his vision on the club and make them back him. Because, like, there was banners there last night celebrating 20 league titles, 3 in a row, hailing Stephen Bradley. But a year, less than a year into his reign, there was banners at Talley calling for him to go. Do you know what I mean? So, like, they could have easily have stuck with that whole short-term thing of, do you know what, it's not working or results weren't coming. But they were able to kind of have that foresight a little bit. And then they delivered. And then they've also had financial backing as well. There's no doubt about that. Ray Wilson, who obviously would be one of the major shareholders and who's based in Australia, would be a big Rovers fan. They have got the support base, obviously, of the 500 club in terms of the supporters who have kept that club going through when they were basically homeless and going from ground to ground around Dublin, like Martin Stadium, Talca Park, the RDS, all these places. And obviously Dermot Desmond has come in recent years and he's pumped in, I think it was around 2 million, and that was for the academy. So, and you tie in with the move to Talla Stadium and the fact that it's owned by South Dublin County Council and they're the anchor tenants. Like, people say, oh, well, you know, it's not their home and all the rest, but they're benefiting because they're able to get these partnerships in place and they're able to operate at a level where people want to be involved with them. And it hasn't happened overnight, because Stephen Bradley took the job in 2016. It was 2019, obviously the COVID year, when COVID hit, when they won the league. And I know people say, oh, well, I remember Pat Hooban saying, you know, it doesn't really count, but like, if you think about it, like, people can forget, but like, they won that league unbeaten. Like, if that league had been a full season, it probably just would have been more embarrassing for Pat Hooban than that, because like, they just would have romped it. Do you know what I mean? Like, they were absolutely hockeying teams and destroying teams, because that was when Bradley's kind of football was beginning to properly come in and how he was setting them up and all the rest of it. And that's basically how it's been. It's just been a case of not repeating the same mistakes as they had been before and actually trusting a manager who's proven to be capable of delivering them success.
I think all the fans of every other League of Ireland club have been pressing you know, plus 30 seconds on this podcast all the way along here. They've just have they stopped talking about Rovers yet? But if they do happen to stumble upon this little segment here, can I ask you, who can possibly challenge them at this point? Is it going to have to be Derry City, who are second this season? Because it doesn't look like any of the Dublin clubs, based on this season, are really up to it at the moment.
Yeah, like you would imagine that Derry will, because obviously the backing they have there now as well, and how they've done in Rory Higgins' fourth season. Like, I think if you go back to May of this year, they were three points ahead in May of Rovers, and in the space of about 10 days, it went that Rovers beat them 1-0 at Tallaght, and then that gap stretched to 7 and 8, and then I think they only picked up like 2 points from 4 games after that, Derry, and that kind of just derailed their title kind of chances. And that's kind of almost what you would expect of a team who was put together that is really good and impressive, but isn't really a full-on team yet, where they'll have those blips. Like, Rovers don't have that at the moment. They are having it previously. Dundalk are another one who will come 100%, because Stephen O'Donnell, and I say this as a Pats fan, and people, this has been said in the pod before, I mean, people know that, but Stephen O'Donnell, the work he did at Pats, the work he did again at Dundalk this season, and the backing that Dundalk have there, and like what I was saying about having a board who trusts you and understand you and kind of believe in you, like, they're going to give him that time to keep on getting it right. And like, O'Donnell has already shown it at Pats after a bit of a struggle coming in through COVID and all at the end of a season, and but then delivering them the FAI Cup and being able to put a really strong team together. Like, he was beginning to get that foundation at Dundalk as well. Like, they were challenging for a while, they were above Derry, they were close to Rovers, and they just drifted. But you would expect that they will come again. Now, the issue here for all three teams, and this is the same for Rovers, Derry and Dundalk, because they will be the three I'll be looking at for next year, where you would Pats have shown after Europe Tim Clancy under Tim Clancy,
yeah,
they can go on a run, but it's sustaining that. But the issue for all those clubs, but mainly Rovers, Dundalk and Derry, is like the pool of players in the league, within the League of Ireland, to actually add and improve isn't great. Like, Rovers have already started, you would expect that there could be signs for them soon. Dundalk the same, and Derry, it's going to be, they're going to have to get players from outside the league as well, to kind of, more so for the other two, to bridge that gap. That's what you'd be looking at, but there's definitely that sense that it'll be them three, and that's, I don't think anyone can really disagree with that at the moment, you know. And it's just interesting as well, because it's three young managers too, you know, Rory Higgins, Stephen O'Donnell, like Stephen Bradley. It kind of echoes what's going on around the league. You see it like just last night, but going to matches, going to Pats matches, going to games for the country, there is just a bit more of a vibrancy with younger people going to watch the football. And it's fantastic. And that's what I'm already kind of looking for. And you look at it, we haven't even, well, we'll probably talk about closer to the time, but the cup final in a couple of weeks, you could have Damien Duff leading an Irish team into European action if they were to be Derry City as well. So there does seem to be a proper vibrancy around the league, you know.
Yeah, what about Duffer then, and what he's done with Shelburne to get them into a cup final in his first season in charge?
Yeah, just a great story, isn't it? Like, people like coming in, like, he, in the league wise, they've probably been exactly what you would expect from a team in the league, where they got players in who are going to work hard and were going to be dogged. And he's like, I think anybody who's looked at them, he just said, you know what, like, he's really got a team together and moulded that kind of camaraderie really together and got a group of players. Like, you speak to, like, I spoke to Sean Boyd and Luke Bourne before their semi-final win over Waterford, and it was just very interesting to hear, because, like you just said, they genuinely, a lot of the players, they just do so much together away from football, as much as that, and there's that sense of, like, a family vibe about it, and they actually brings more out of them. They feel as if when they're out on the pitch, they're with their mates, and like, they go a bit of the extra yard for each other, because like, they actually like each other. Do you know what I mean? Like, there, and that's what Duff had wanted in the first year, and it's pretty clever management there and smart in terms of getting that, because that's what you need from a newly promoted team, is having that bit of a work ethic. And then you add in being able to go on that cup run and getting the win over Bowes in the quarterfinals, and then obviously Waterford, who were in flying form, and it, I don't know if you saw it, but the conditions down in the RSC that night were absolutely horrific. It was like a monsoon down there, and like, the team that Duff had put together were able to come through that. And again, similar to Bradley, it's just a different challenge for him next season. It's going to be, well, and also because there's investment in Shells as well. Maybe not quite to the level of of say of a Rovers or a Derry or Dundalk, but significant enough where even after one season of consolidation, little old shells, as Duff thinks people call them, they will be expected now to actually to hit the next level. And if they can finish this season with the FA Cup and go into Europe, it's just going to add to another great part of the story of this season.
Isn't David cracking stuff? Thanks so much.
No bother, lad. It's good to talk to you.
I said, Karen, it's Richard Keys. Prehistoric banter.
Please, it was just banter.
Is not acceptable in a modern world.
Do you have any regrets?
None. There are some dark forces at work here.
The eyes have it. The eyes have it. Unlock.
Just a quick add-on to that piece, Ken. David Snaid has been back in touch since we recorded that conversation.
Yes.
With an important piece of information.
Yes, he was able to identify the song from his notes that he didn't recognize. You know what the song was that David Snaid did not recognize?
Go on.
Do you recognize it yet? No.
No Limits, sorry.
No Limits.
I was going to say Mr. Vane.
No Limits. No. There's no limit. This was the song that he didn't recognize.
He thought it was Freed was from Desire. But listen, I got it wrong there as well. So
yeah.
Well done also to the Shelburne women's team, who for the second year in a row won the league on the final day of the season. Last year, they won their last match 3-2 to nick the title from Wexford Youths, who lost on the final day. This year was more straightforward. At least as straightforward as a title win on the final day can be. They beat Wexford Youths 4-0 to make any other results irrelevant. So well done to them. And well done also to everyone who ran the Dublin Marathon yesterday. Not sure, Ken, if you remember a number of years ago, back in my early marathon running days, the subject of whether or not I could run a faster marathon than David Gillick came up on air. Do you remember this? It's kind of a weird thing you might remember.
David Gillick. I mean, I would say he would probably run a faster marathon than you.
Well, this is what you said at the time, Ken. In fact, Murph scoffed at the notion that I could beat an Olympian, a European champion, as I patiently explained.
He is a racehorse, though, of course. And you're a cart horse.
The cart horse. This is exactly the cart horse. My point was the cart horse. Look, there are a lot of 400 metres within the 26.2 miles. I would never doubt that David Gillick would beat me over 400 metres. That was never up for discussion.
Yeah.
But 800 metres, I'd say he'd still have the edge. It was just, at what distance could you possibly think I could beat David Gillick? I felt marathon distance. That's where I would take him. Well, David Gillick ran his first ever marathon yesterday, Ken.
Uh-huh.
And he absolutely obliterated my best ever time.
So what did he do?
Gillick's PB, 3 hours, 16 minutes. 53 seconds.
That's
McDevitt's PB, 3 hours 42.06. So on this occasion, 13 years later, I'm prepared to admit yourself and Murph were correct.
That's pretty good. But I feel that I have to mention the great Kieran Cassidy.
Go on.
Given that you're given that David Gillick, a former Olympic athlete, is running, what did you say, 3:16?
3:16:53, yeah. What did our pal Cass do then?
Well, Kieran Cassidy, who obviously was producing the Where's George Gibney podcast with Mark, ran a phenomenal 3:13.
Oh, destroying David Gillick.
3:13. He destroys David Gillick. So Kieran Cassidy's nearly as old as myself. He may even be older. But he's.
I wonder was Mark behind the scenes doing the reverse? Okay, deep breaths now. Deep breaths, as in the Where is George Gibney series.
Yeah. Now it's, he did end up in the medical tent, Cass, but thankfully all's well that ends well.
Good.
And it was a phenomenal time and a great story to tell everybody he meets for the rest of his life.
I feel bad. I missed Cass. I was there watching it and I did see Gillick go past, but I didn't see Cass go past.
Well, he was too fast.
He was too quick.
If there was a red blur at any point to just pass, that was probably him. So,
thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Owen.
Thanks for listening. The Second Captain's podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network. To hear every episode ad free, just become a World Service member. Simple as that.
Which one is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home. Those boys.
The second captain's
World Service.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.